You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
This panel, we're going to be addressing the issue of the imperative of economic liberalisation from the perspective of Taiwan and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We've got a very strong panel here today. On my right, we have Terry Cook, who I will introduce shortly. I believe you have some biographical material anyway, but he is going to provide a broad historical perspective on a range of the trade and economic issues surrounding Taiwan. And to my left is Mr. Lin, who is going to provide a slightly more detailed discussion around Taiwan and the WTO. I understand you may critique some of the papers that I've written with Richard Bush, so I'm looking forward to that. And then I'm going to provide a bit of a perspective of some of the economic challenges that are facing Taiwan. I think it will actually build quite well on the excellent speech we heard before from Vincent Chu and how the TPP can be an important vehicle for economic reform in Taiwan. Just to introduce my panellists briefly, to my right I have Terry Cook, who's the founder of the China Partnership of Greater Philadelphia, which is a non-profit platform accelerating public-private collaboration between Greater Philadelphia and China in clean energy and energy-efficient buildings. He's also a senior fellow at the T.C. Chan Center for Building Simulation and Energy Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. He's been a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center here in Washington, D.C., and has also written quite extensively about clean energy issues, including a book which came out recently on US-China cooperation in clean energy. He's also had a distinguished career, served as director for Asian Corporate Partnerships at the World Economic Forum, and before that had a 15-year career in the senior in the Foreign Commercial Service, which included stints in Taipei, Beijing and Tokyo. Mr. Lin is actually the former ambassador of Taiwan's permanent mission to the WTO. Previously, he was a director in Taiwan's trade office for Far East Trade in Canada. He's also worked as deputy director general for the Bureau of Foreign Trade. In 1995, he became director general of that bureau, and following that was deputy minister, and then in 2002 became minister for the Ministry of Economic Affairs. We're going to talk each for approximately 10 minutes each, and then after that we're going to open up to Q&A from the audience. Terry.
Thank you very much, Joshua. It's always a pleasure for me to be involved in an event with Taiwan. At a personal level, my history with Taiwan goes back to 1977 when I showed up at the Guoji Qingyan Huodong Zhongxin, and the only options for breakfast at that time were doujiang and youqiao. So Taiwan had a light economy at that point. I came back as section chief at AIT from the years 1999 to 2002 and had the great honor to be involved under AIT Director Raymond Burkhart with Taiwan's accession to the WTO, and a particularly memorable delegation that I organized to the United States with Wang Zhongyu and Benny Hu and Shi Yensheng and many, many other people who happened to be on my at my house on September 9th, 2001. And we were all together at the University of Pennsylvania promoting biotechnology links between Taiwan and the Mid-Atlantic when the Twin Towers were struck. The imperative of economic liberalization, I've been asked by Kevin and Joshua to step back a little bit from the alphabet soup and from the spaghetti bowl and to take a broader Google Maps perspective. So I'm going to do that in three steps. I'm going to step back first to 1945, the immediate post-World War II environment. It was, of course, a uniquely unipolar world at that moment, and we were in the process of creating a number of institutions which have come collectively to be known as the Bretton Woods institutions, the World Trade Organization, the IMF, the World Bank. But the two things that I want to focus on from that time have to do with the drivers that are impelling economic liberalization, trade liberalization, and economic integration. And I would say they're simply the drivers of technology and of globalization. So in 1945, in my hometown, Philadelphia, there was a building almost the size of the Brookings Building, which housed the ENIAC computer, which had been used during World War II to calculate the trajectory of shells, military ordnance. We think recently of living in an age of Moore's Law, but actually the driver of technology change had started well before that time and is likely to continue well beyond our time right now in 2013. There had been the wave of electromechanical technology change, then relay technology, then vacuum tubes, then transistors, and then integrated circuits. And we're now in a time of DNA computation and of nano processors. So this imperative, which was even being felt back at the time of World War II, is not only continuing, it's accelerating and will continue to drive, as it has for the last 60 years, the need for further and deeper economic integration and trade liberalization. And similarly, there's a very famous 4-minute YouTube by a Dutchman named Hans Roerling, where he plots life expectancy and also per capita income on a very fancy transparent screen. And from World War II, you have most of the world going from the lower left-hand corner on a very impressive trajectory up towards higher per capita income, higher longevity. And that is the demographic and globalization imperative that is helping move things forward. Now, technically, the millennium began on January 1st, 2001, although it's popularly thought of beginning in the year 2000. And just at about that time, Taiwan and China jointly entered the World Trade Organization. A couple of fairly obvious points that I would like to make about that particular moment. The possibility of Taiwan and China joining more or less simultaneously, with China's entry preceding Taiwan's by several minutes, did, of course, reflect a softening of political rigidities that had been in place since World War II. A couple of lessons about the enduring effect of political rigidities. I think Taiwan's 10-year experience after joining the WTO, if one were to sum it up very succinctly and perhaps a little bit harshly, would be to say that having made it into the WTO club, Taiwan a little bit looked around the world and hoped to be have made it. But what happened during the 10 years since Taiwan's accession, while Taiwan has been an excellent performer within WTO disciplines, there has been a hyperdrive of other types of trade organizations, trade associations, particularly in economically affluent Asia, particularly driven by emerging China. And so it is, the situation that just comes up so often in life, that having made a huge effort to arrive somewhere, instead of having a chance to rest and enjoy things, the imperative is actually to catch your breath really quickly and get right back to work on the next level of challenge. And the final point I'll make about this WTO period is actually with reference to China and the Chinese market. I will make a point about its internal use, and I hope in the question and answers that someone will give me an opportunity to mention how China has used the World Trade Organization in its global development of a wind power and solar industry, because it's quite instructive and important to understand. But for keeping time short, I just want to say that when I arrived as a commercial officer in Shanghai in 1988, I had the honor of meeting for 15 minutes each Zhu Rongji and Jiang Zemin. And Zhu Rongji's use of the World Trade Organization to drive and overcome internal political resistance to change and economic liberalization in China is quite an interesting story. And it's one that I think Taiwanese understand much better than Americans do, but there's just an interesting hand-in-glove phenomenon of how China has used external trade liberalization regimes to overcome political and internal rigidities in its own country and to further open it up to globalization and economic prosperity. So the most recent and final step in my stepping back to look at the current TPP moment is to 2010 and the formalization of the ECFA, the Economic Cooperation Framework Agreement between Taiwan and China. This really represents a rationalization of trade flows and a rationalization of economic integration within Asia. There were, of course, important lessons about how historical antagonists could work to overcome deep political differences, to agree on important economic shared interests. The sequencing of elements of the ECFA agreement was a key part of that. The prioritizing of effort was a key part of that. The concluding point that I would like to make about the ECFA, since we're here in Washington, D.C., is more directed to friends, colleagues, and compatriots who are from the U.S. and who are not as familiar with Asia, because there is a enormous opportunity for American businesses to understand what the ECFA is, how it can help them in Asia, and how they can work the trilateral relationship between the U.S., Taiwan, and China to everyone's benefit, while in the process protecting intellectual property, upholding environmental standards and labor standards. So the case in point, which I hope I'll have an opportunity to speak to more in the question and answer session, is that in my hometown of Philadelphia, we have a new U.S. National Center for Energy Efficient Buildings. Buildings consume 40% of all energy in the United States, in China, and in Taiwan. In fact, buildings in the U.S. and Greater China emit 16% of all global carbon. And This is a important program. It's a government-mandated program in Beijing and also in Washington, D.C. And it's clear that companies in our region who have innovations that could be deployed rapidly in the Chinese market are looking for a model of how they can do that with trusted business partners who are familiar with Western standards of doing business. So big opportunity, lack of understanding here in the U.S. about what the ECFA potentially means. So with that, I'll conclude and turn things over to our expert, other than to say that from that look back over 60 years, I think some of the key lessons here are that technology and globalization as a driving force recommending the TPP are not going to go away. We're no longer in the unipolar world that we were in post-World War II. Potentially this can be for everybody's benefit, but we have to learn how to work smart to make that work to everyone's benefit. And agreements like the ECFA and the TPP are a part of that. And I think it's a natural stage to move trade agreements to a 21st century focus on issues like innovation, protecting the intellectual property that leads to innovation, and sustainability, both in terms of environmental sustainability and the sustainability of the workforces that produce the products. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Lin.
Thank you. Distinguished audience, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure and honor to be here as one of the panelists at this Taiwan and the TPP seminar at this very prestigious institution. I just want to make some comment on Joshua's paper titled Taiwan's Economic Opportunities and the Challenges and the Importance of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Joshua provides a good illustration of Taiwan's current trade and investment climate and some of the current challenges facing Taiwan in this Brookings Center for Northeast Asian Policy Studies working paper. Our government is closely following the numerous trade agreement developments in the region, and we fully appreciate the extent of Taiwan's vulnerability to potential trade diversion as trade agreements excluding Taiwan proliferate. Taiwan's full participation in regional trade liberalization is essential, as noted by President Ma in his recent Double 10 national address. I quote, "In order to become a free economic island, Taiwan must comprehensively take part in regional economic integration. Only if we have the courage to compete can we create economic prosperity. This is the only way forward for the structural transformation of Taiwan economy," unquote. Accordingly, our policies are aligned to ensure continuous economic opening, many of which Joshua has noted in his paper. Though the study provides important points on how the TPP will enhance Taiwan's economic position in the region, Joshua fails to note what Taiwan brings to the table of great benefit to the current 12 members of TPP. According to a 2012 study by the Zhonghua Institution for Economic Research, Taiwan's inclusion in the TPP would lead to an overall gain of $88.4 billion in social welfare for all members. As a leading supplier of intermediate goods and components in Asia-Pacific's supply chains, Taiwan's TPP membership will contribute to forming more durable, integrated, and efficient supply chains across the Asia-Pacific. Taiwan is also the 10th largest economy in terms of its trade volume among the 21 APEC economies. We believe Taiwan's being part of TPP is very much a two-way street. All would benefit from the higher quality integration Taiwan's inclusion signifies. Joshua has captured the highlights of our government responses to economic liberalization and the joining trade agreement. This includes our expansion of economic cooperation framework agreement, the recently ratified cooperation agreement with New Zealand, and the just signing of economic partnership agreement with Singapore. Beyond the policy solutions noted in the paper, Taiwan is working to gather political support from the current TPP members. Taiwan has engaged extensively with the other TPP members about the desirability of Taiwan's potential TPP membership. Most recently, at this Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum in Bali in early October, Japanese Prime Minister Abe extended his support to Taiwan during his meeting with President Ma's representative, our leader of this visiting delegation, former Vice President Winston Xu. In the United States, Taiwan has also gained strong support from congressional members regarding participation in TPP. Taiwan will continue its effort to build support with all TPP members and leverage this external relationship while pushing for domestic reforms and further economic opening. Let me also speak from the perspective of the WTO. During my post as Taiwan's ambassador to the WTO, Taiwan has been a strong supporter of ambitious Doha Round. Even we have committed ourselves to bound 100% of its tariffs, and our commitment level in our service schedule is more advanced than most other WTO members during our accession. Furthermore, in WTO, Taiwan has demonstrated a strong willingness to work alongside the U.S. to expand and modernize the ongoing 1996 Information Technology Agreement, ITA, and initiate the negotiations on the Trade in Service Agreement, TISA. Let me conclude by saying that implementing economic reforms and removing barriers to increase Taiwan's international competitiveness and domestic operating efficiency are important policy priorities for Taiwan. Our government has laid out a roadmap to meet the TPP standard of liberalization, communicate with affected sectors, and rally domestic support. We look forward to having more interaction with and support from the United States as we continue to liberalize our economy, engage in multilateral and regional trade negotiations, and deepen the bilateral economic relationship. I thank you.
Thank you. That was fantastic. I'm going to, in my allotted time, build a little bit of probably on what's been said before. I'm going to focus a little, in my first part on what I see to be some of the key parts of the Taiwan economic model. And I think then this will lead quite well into what some of the challenges are to that model going forward, which I think will set the scene for a discussion about the role of the TPP in the context of addressing a range of these challenges for Taiwan. Certainly, I think what's clear is Taiwan is heavily integrated in regional supply chains in Asia, largely with a focus on the IT sector, but not solely. And in many respects, it's a question of goods being manufactured either in Taiwan, possibly parts of China, ASEAN, moved across borders often multiple times, often for final assembly in China, possibly in Taiwan, with export to large sort of developed country markets such as the US and elsewhere. And Taiwan businesses have traditionally engaged in what is often referred to as contract manufacturing, again, in the IT sector. I think a very good example of this, which everyone is probably familiar with, is Foxconn, which is a Taiwanese business located in China, which manufactures Apple products, iPads, iPhones, but also is the manufacturer of probably approximately half of the world's top branded computers, mobile phones for Nokia, LCD TVs for Sony and the like. So the idea of contract manufacturing captures the idea that it's the production of a lot of goods which are then branded under other company names and sold as consumer goods in other markets. This is not to say that Taiwan doesn't have its own brands. Many of you probably are aware of Asus, for instance. But Taiwan certainly is not, as far as the final branded category goes, in the same league, for instance, as you might see from Japan and Korea. This model essentially has been premised on significant levels of foreign investment and international trade. And my description of how this works leads to this conclusion quite obviously. And so we see that Taiwan businesses have invested very significantly in China, in ASEAN countries, to develop manufacturing sites, and particularly over time, as costs of manufacturing in Taiwan have gone up, there's been a move to do more of this in lower cost destinations. And this has been built on significant international trade, so the movement of parts and components between Taiwan and its other manufacturing centres in the Asian region has obviously been key. So we see in some of the figures, for instance, that trade is approximately 140% of Taiwanese GDP, just to give you a sense of the significance, and approximately 70% of Taiwan's exports are in fact in intermediate goods. Again, just building the picture of the role of Taiwan in global supply chains in that region. Just picking up the point about the movement of goods and the role of trade there, what this manufacturing system requires and often leads to is a movement of goods across multiple borders, often many times in order before it's finally assembled and exported. And so what this means is that trade costs, in terms of the actual cost of the final good, can be quite significant because of the movement through many jurisdictions. And this means that even small changes in trade costs can have fairly significant impacts on the overall costs and competitiveness of products. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about this in the context of what this means from Taiwan's exclusion from free trade agreements in that region. We've also heard talk, and I'll just mention, we think it's worthwhile mentioning again, we've seen some changes in Taiwan's trade patterns over time. We heard before that the United States is now Taiwan's third largest trading partner, whereas it used to be the first in the 1990s, and China has now become Taiwan's largest trading partner. Though I will note, part of this is not, in terms of the influence of the United States on Taiwan and the significance, it doesn't necessarily lead to the conclusion that there is so much of a lessening. And I haven't seen the HSBC report that was referred to before, but you know, we've seen a lot of this happening where countries that used to export directly to the United States are still exporting, but via third countries such as China. So again, if we take the Foxconn example, that's recorded in statistics as a Chinese export, even though it's coming from a Taiwanese business. So the ultimate significance of the United States economy on Taiwan can still be a lot larger than the mere fact that it's the third largest trading partner would suggest. Now, in terms of the economic challenges, we've heard a bit about this already, but essentially the model of contract manufacturing relies on very thin margins, and these essentially are being squeezed from a range of directions. One of them is that the low-cost manufacturing sectors are not becoming so low-cost anymore. I mean, certainly when it comes to China, we know that there's been rapid increases, for instance, in the cost of labour. And so the margins have been thinned out there, and we're seeing a response to that where there's some increased Chinese investment in lower-cost destinations in ASEAN, such as Vietnam. Significantly, I think, is Taiwan's exclusion in this context from the growing range of free trade agreements in the area. I think it's worth just noting that the first problem, of course, has been the inability to move on the Doha round. I'm not saying that would solve everything for Taiwan, but it's certainly been an important factor which has led to, A, the proliferation of FTAs, and it's also mean that the MFN value in the WTO has become significantly less valuable as more and more preferences have been granted under free trade agreements. And we've heard a bit today already about the proliferation of what have become actually now very significant trade initiatives. I'm just going to mention a few. TPP, which we're going to talk more about this afternoon. RCEP, which we've also heard about. There's been a range of ASEAN plus FTAs, which Taiwan has not been part of. And in addition, there's a potential FTA between China and Korea, which actually could be quite significant from a competitive perspective for Taiwan, given that Korea and Taiwan are actually competitive on a range of product lines. Trilateral between China, Korea and Japan, and a potential Japan-EU FTA. So there's a range of liberalisation initiatives going on, which are going to all be have an impact on China in various ways. There's also, I think, a range of challenges which Taiwan's facing, which are really quite domestic in focus. And some of them I'm going to highlight. One of them is, I think, probably what you could call excessive government regulation. In this respect, I refer to the most recent World Bank Ease of Doing Business report, which ranks Taiwan 16th, which overall is fairly respectable, but regionally is behind Malaysia and Korea and Hong Kong. There's been a challenge in Taiwan from stagnant wages, which has led to somewhat of a brain drain to regional centres such as Singapore and Hong Kong. And we've seen a change in composition broadly in China's in Taiwan's economy from manufacturing becoming a less significant part of the economy as manufacturing has moved to other parts of the region, which in and of itself is not necessarily problematic. Services have grown and are now approximately 70% of GDP, which is a trajectory you would expect a developed country to follow, except in Taiwan's case, the services sector in terms of productivity is still quite low and is acting as somewhat of a drag on growth. And so one of the challenges certainly going forward is how to improve the efficiency broadly of the services sector. I think this leads into a discussion about the significance of TPP for Taiwan. We've heard, and we're going to hear more this afternoon about the strategic significance of the TPP. And I don't want to get into that in too much detail, though in many respects it is hard to separate out some of the economic and strategic elements of it. The United States and the administration is very explicit that the TPP is the economic pillar of its rebalancing towards Asia. We've heard somewhat of an overview of the TPP, so I'm not going to go into that in too much detail. I mean, this grew out from the original P4, which involved New Zealand, Singapore, Brunei and Chile. The United States joined in 2008, Australia, Vietnam, Malaysia shortly afterwards, Peru, Canada and Mexico in 2012, and Japan recently in July this year. It represents about 40% of global GDP. We know that there's a range of countries who are interested in joining. Korea's signaled its interest, Indonesia and others. And the ambition is for this to be a pathway to a free trade agreement of the Asia-Pacific region. I think it's just worthwhile keeping this ambition in mind because I think it also is it influences how we think about the significance of the TPP now, given where the aim of it is in the future. Now, In the papers that Richard and I have co-authored, I think one of the points that we make, and I hope this comes through quite clearly, is that we really see the significance of the TPP, at least from one perspective, as a driver of economic reform in Taiwan. Now, before I get to that, I just want to touch briefly on the market access component of it. Just a couple of figures. Five of Taiwan's top 10 export destinations are TPP members, and they represent about 35% of Taiwan's total trade. So just purely in terms of new market access for exports, it's significant for Taiwan. I think the other part, which is very important, is what the TPP will mean for supply chains in the region. And in this regard, the rules of origin and how they get written are going to change supply chains in that region. For those who follow the minutiae of this, there is an issue with regards to the United States and Vietnam over rules of origin for textiles, which will influence Taiwan as a supplier of yarn to Vietnam. And it's a small issue, but I think it just is an illustrative example of how the TPP will change the way countries source inputs. And given Taiwan's role in providing inputs into the production of other goods, Taiwan really wants to be part of the TPP to make sure that it's in the tent and not out of the tent when it comes to how these supply chains develop. Vincent mentioned, and I think it's just worth mentioning again, the importance of the TPP in terms of the balance of China's economic relationships, and this goes to the issue of China's and Taiwan's economic growing economic relationship and the capacity to give Taiwan options in the region. I just want to focus now a little bit on the domestic component to it, and I'm just going to point out some of the areas that are being developed in the TPP and what this can mean for domestic reform in Taiwan. I want to start with the services component. Broadly speaking, the TPP is ambitious. People talk about it as a gold standard or a platinum standard, and part of that is going to be deep liberalisation on tariffs. The ambition is to go to zero on everything, certainly on services to go a lot further than was achieved in the WTO context. I think the opportunity on services liberalisation can, you know, be a very important driver of reform in Thailand. I mentioned before the growing significance of the services sector in Taiwan. Opening up that sector to greater competition is itself going to drive efficiency and productivity in that sector. But I think the important part as well here is the role of services in economies generally, and certainly it's true of Taiwan's, as inputs into the production of other services or other goods. So the implications are really economy-wide. And so we can see that liberalisation of the services sector in Taiwan can actually have productivity improvements across the Taiwanese economy. Taiwan's also got a very highly skilled workforce. Again, the World Bank ranking puts Taiwan above the United Kingdom, for instance, in terms of its skilled workers, which are arguably proving underutilised to some extent. I think this is partly reflected in wage levels and brain drain I was talking about before. Allowing highly skilled services firms into China, building up the services sector, again, is really the pathway, I think, for Taiwan's future prosperity, and in that respect, TPP can certainly assist in moving along that direction. On the intellectual property front, we can expect, again, intellectual property standards which are going to be beyond what has been agreed to in the WTO. Taiwan certainly already has very strong intellectual property standards, but the TPP will require ratcheting up in some areas. And again, as a centre of R&D, which is to some extent what we're seeing the manufacturing sector evolve to a little bit in Taiwan, where some of the high-level R&D is happening and the manufacturing is happening elsewhere, I think this signals and also underpins this type of economic model going forward for Taiwan. I just want to talk briefly about investment because we all know that investment, foreign investment, is a very important conduit for technology, for services, for world's best practice management. And certainly President Ma has recognised that Taiwan certainly needs more foreign investment. And so there's going to be a comprehensive investment chapter in the TPP which would very much support these goals. This is both on the market access side, so it would liberalise the opportunities for investment in Taiwan, which is one important component. The other is we can expect some fairly comprehensive rules around investment protection, including investor-state dispute settlement. And both of these combined should create an improved environment in Taiwan for foreign investment. There's a range of other issues, I think, which all added up are going to be important from a reform perspective in Taiwan. I've just mentioned cross-border data flows is another, where the aim is basically to have a rule which allows for cross-border data flows with some tailored exceptions. And, you know, this is significant. It's setting the scene, basically, to make sure that some of the new IT-enabled services, which are going to be crucial, really, for productivity growth going further forward, such as access to cloud computing, et cetera, are enabled. And that's going to be certainly key for Taiwan's economy. Another cross-cutting issue is on regulatory coherence, where the aim here is basically to set up a procedure for regulation which emphasises transparency and stakeholder input, and essentially it gets at some of the governance issues around making regulation. And I think this is also going to be important. We've heard over the course of the day of the importance of this process and making it kind of more streamlined and more efficient. There's actually a WTO report out from a few years ago which talks about how Taiwan's standard-making process has increasingly departed from international norms, and opening up the standard-making process, I think, to international input and stakeholder consultation, I think, might help address that, certainly. So these are a variety of issues where Taiwan's participation in the TPP is going to essentially be very consistent and parallel with a lot of the economic reforms it needs to make anyway. And this gets back to the point that's been made before about the WTO, which is that the TPP, like the WTO, can be an external driver of economic reform in Taiwan, and we think that's actually a very important part of the way we think about why Taiwan should be a TPP member. I was going to spend a little bit of time talking about the importance of the rest of the TPP members for having Taiwan in, but Mr. Lin, you have provided an excellent overview of that. I just want to add a couple of very small points, and some of them have to some extent already been made. There's obviously a very important and somewhat politically sensitive issue around ECFA. On the one hand, the development of closer economic cooperation between Taiwan and China is very natural and is beneficial from an economic perspective for Taiwan and for China. But this is always being overlaid by concerns about what this might mean for Taiwan and the political implications. So I think that to some extent, TPP membership can provide Taiwan with further confidence to engage closely with China. It will provide that type of balancing in the economic relationship that Vincent was talking about. And I think that in and of itself is also good from a US strategic perspective, which is always made clear that peaceful development of cross-straits relationship is a US priority. So I think before I leave it at that, I just want to talk briefly about the accession process. We've talked about the accession process in some detail in our paper. We described the steps that Vietnam went through and that Japan went through in order to accede. We don't know what an accession process is going to look like in the TPP, but clearly Taiwan's not going to be part of this first round of TPP parties, and the agreement's going to be signed and most likely have passed Congress before Taiwan is able to join. So having an accession process that actually works, that's realistic, that's pragmatic, is going to be key. There isn't a lot of history around accession processes working in free trade agreements. And so getting that bit right, I think, is also going to be key going forward. Okay, with that, I'd like to open it up to Q&A. There's a microphone going around. If you could introduce yourself, and when you ask your question, I'll take a couple of questions to start with. If you are asking a question to a specific panelist, please identify who. There's one up the back there, just behind you. Yeah.
Chong Jianden from Department of Diplomacy, National Change University, Taipei, Taiwan. I just like to share my observation about Taiwan's economic liberalization. Cook and Mr. Lin mentioned something about WTO or ECFA or free trade agreement with New Zealand and Singapore, but I'd like to mention something about TIFA, I know most of you must remember TIFA, not just TIFA, but also the related measures taken by the United States at that era in 1990s and 1980s and 1990s. Remember, at that moment, economic, not just economic, but also financial liberalization to push Taiwan to liberalize its foreign exchange regime. Remember, also open its monopoly over wine, tobacco, and liquor, plus part of its agricultural sectors. At that moment, I remember, I just back from the United States, a lot, very strong opposition, especially from the farmer. I remember Minister of Economics, that is Vincent Shaw, he was hit by the eggs, okay? But anyway, some people think that disaster, especially to liberalize all these kind of sectors. But we got through. I believe that period of time of economic liberalization really paved the way for Taiwan join WTO. So that is, I'd like to remind, this is important. Also, you can see Taiwan's determination and commitment. Remember, Vincent Shaw was the Minister of Economics. President Ma was the Deputy Secretary General of KMT. They observed what happened in that era, the protests and all these kind of things. Taiwan got through. Okay, that's my observation there for waiting for your comments. Thank you.
Thanks. Just at the front here. And then.
Bill Tucker, my question is to you, Joshua. Why has the service sector lagged behind the rest of the development and in Taiwan? We've done a lot of work in that area, and I'd like to see your answer.
Okay, Ken Wen from TBAA. I got a question for Joshua. Joshua and Richard Bush recently have a paper, I think last month, talking about TPP and Taiwan. And based on that paper, I think you probably need 10 years to get into the TPP because you are so many steps over there, and every step is very difficult. So the other question I have is, do you think the TPP is an economical tool for United States to contain China? Because China have a 19.2% of population, but they are not included in the TPP. Okay, so this is my question for Joshua. Thank you.
I'm just going to take those questions quickly and then we'll move on. Just quickly on the services sector part, I think it's a combination of reasons. I think the services sector tends to be small, the companies in it, and so have not got the type of efficiencies that you see from larger services sector companies. They tend not to be trade exposed or exposed to enough competition generally, which has also been a factor in it. I think there's a couple of other reasons, but I think those are the main ones so far. On the TPP question, we're going to talk a bit more about the politics around joining the TPP in the next panel, so I'm going to leave that for Richard Bush. I'll just say I don't think it's correct to think about the TPP as a containment strategy. This has been raised many, many times, obviously, since the TPP has been commenced. I think on one level, it's the wrong way of thinking about trade and China. This was a sort of a strategy that worked during the Cold War, and for various reasons is something that's completely not only implausible vis-a-vis China, but is also not a US goal. I think the goal with the TPP for the United States is as a sort of an economic hedge in a way. I think that there has been concern about the way the Chinese economy has developed over the last 10, 15 years with a greater role for state enterprises and ownership of factors of production. And, you know, there's been... China's done a lot in terms of liberalisation under its WTO commitments, but it's also true that doing business in China has become increasingly hard from an investment perspective, from an IP perspective and the like. And for this is an attempt, I think, to set a high level of rules, a range across of industries, and also that reinforce a particular role for the market in development going forward, which I think the United States would very much like to see China be on board on. I think the ultimate aim, in fact, is for China to join the TPP. I think that would be the most beneficial outcome for the United States and for the Asia and globally. And so the hope is, and we've talked a little bit about this before, is that the TPP might be a bit like what the WTO was for China 12, 13 years ago, where it's ultimately going to be a question for China domestically, the reform path it wants to take. We've had the plenum recently, and there certainly appears to be an ambitious reform agenda there. So the question is, if China wants to go down that pathway, the TPP could be a useful vehicle to help underpin and drive that domestic reform in China. And so whether that is actually what happens, I think, is still to be seen.
Nadia Chow with the Liberty Times Taiwan. I just have a question for Ambassador Ling. We know that any liberalization, there will be a winner and loser. And in Taiwan, you know, if the government really serious about joining TPP, have you have the idea, you know, who will be the loser and who will be the winner? And budget-wise and policy-wise, can we hear more detail, you know, what's Taiwan government's roadmap? Thank you.
This lady at the back here, and then you.
I'm Helen Raffel with Resources for the Future, and Mr. Cook, you invited us to ask you to tell us more about wind and solar energy developments, and I'm eager to do so.
One more down the front.
I wanted to ask a question that I guess was almost the flip side sectorally from an earlier question on the service sector. And that was, I mean, the Taiwanese manufacturing sector is also dominated by many small firms, you know, ASUS and HTC, accepting. But, you know, they're, like you said, unbranded, right? And so the question, my question is, how is it that you would see the TPP helping catalyze a more development of brands, especially as branded goods, and this is a question for all the panelists, especially as they're exposed to greater competition and more parts of the supply chain when everyone else is trying to do the same thing, right? And so, you know, where is it, and do you think it's that's the right way of thinking about it, or are there other impediments to development of the branded goods sector in Taiwan?
Let's
In my remark, I have already mentioned that our government has laid out a roadmap to meet the TPP standard of liberalization. Certainly, there will be some sectors benefited, and other sectors affected. And our government has already started our communication with the affected sectors. And certainly, we have to rally the logistic support, you know, for possible membership of TPP. I think whether I have already answered your question. No? Well, certainly we have to identify, you know, which sectors are most affected and less affected, which sectors are benefited, and this is in our government plan, and probably Francis can.
I think the question is for every FTA negotiation, there are winners and losers. In this case, who will be the losers? Who will be the winners upon TPP accession or negotiation? That's the first question. The second question, what are the budget and part of the measures the government adopted to help those who might be the losers? Firstly, just like we said, many traditional industries that if they can develop differentiation features, they could still be the winner in the market. So we say there's no sunset industry. They are sunset products. Just in the same spirit,
for FTAs, we don't think there are any industry that are going to be definite losers. For instance, when we joined WTO in 2002, many people were worried about our agriculture sector because, in general, the weak sectors are those who are not competitive in the global market. That is basically supplying domestic need. So those, by definition, is so-called the weaker segments of the market. But even for Taiwanese, the agriculture sector actually grew relatively in the past 10, 11 years after our accession to WTO. And so we had a thorough review, for instance, in our ECFA exercise, because the government has established a $3.3 billion fund for assisting those industries that are affected by trade liberalization. And only a few sectors are actually named. That's the budget part you mentioned, about $3.3 billion budget in 10 years period that will be used to assist industries that are negatively impacted by trade liberalization as a matter of trade negotiation. That is one thing. Now, another thing is that we will help those industries to do their personnel training, their capacity building, their international marketing. So we have quite some think tanks and institutions that we fully use to help those industries to create a task force on the industry. So, thank you.
Great, thank you.
Well, thank you for the question. As a private citizen, I want to be clear about the frame that I'm using in telling the story very, very quickly. Normal narratives about WTO is it's fair, it's not fair. I'm actually interested in the questions of what's happening, why is it happening, and what's to be done about it. From 2000 to 2005, the Danish wind turbine manufacturer Vestas put more wind turbines into China than virtually any other company, except maybe GE Turbine. And by 2005, Vestas had a 36% share of the Chinese market. However, during the last few years of that period, through government suasion, Vestas was encouraged to be training a new generation of wind turbine engineers. And then in 2005, there was a new local content regulation announced that had the effect from the year 2005 to 2010. Here are the two effects. Vestas's sales in China did not drop. Their market share dropped from 36% to 3%. In other words, the market expanded in China so dramatically during that five-year period that a single company could keep its sales slightly growing but lose out to competitors to the extent that they went from 36% of the market to 3% of the market. How did this happen? Because China is in a unique ability or position to leverage its scale and its speed. This was brought to the WTO as a trade complaint. The WTO ruled against China. It took 5 years. By the time the trade ruling was announced, the global market had fundamentally changed. But let's remember, when the ruling was found against China, they said, oh, sorry. And they stepped back, and they stayed from that point on, once the finding was leveled, within the WTO boundaries. So they are playing a shrewd, aggressive game, and they're playing within rules that they did not author in the first place. It's us up to the United States, I believe, as a U.S. citizen, to understand what's happening and to update our own rules so we get better world results.
Thanks. Let me just answer quickly the question about brands. Look, there's in terms of whether the Taiwanese industry moves up that chain and actually has its own brands is not fundamentally going to be driven by TPP membership. It's going to be a strategic decision that Taiwanese businesses make. I think, though, if given sort of the way I've painted, I guess, the challenges, I mean, you might think that that's a pathway that more and more are going to pursue. And certainly, to the extent that that is the case, the type of liberalisation that the TPP would lead to, I think, would create an enabling environment which would help that transition. I think one of the challenges in actually becoming a successful branded company is, in fact, very much on the services tail end, on the marketing, the advertising, and that type of strategic decision-making end, which, you know, is going to rely essentially on a lot of, at least initially, overseas expertise. And that's going, and in order to sort of access that at a competitive price, and in Taiwan is going to actually require both foreign direct investment and opening up of the services market. So that's going to be driven by the TPP, and then it's going to be up to Taiwan businesses to what extent they want to take advantage of that, I think. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of our session. I want to thank you all and for your participation, and we've got approximately 10 minutes, and then we'll be proceeding to the next panel.